You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. In case you missed the news, like so many of you out there, I caught COVID. I've been recovering, but it's been pretty nasty. To cover for content, we're going to be playing some of our YouTube backlog into our regular feed. The episode you're about to hear is part of our young series that we're calling Debased on a True Story, where we take a look at classic horror movies alleged to be inspired by true events or based on true events. For our first effort, we're taking a look at the 1977 Wes Craven film, The Hills Have Eyes. First, we'll take a look at the movie and the story it portrays, and then we'll dig into the strange legend that Wes Craven says he was inspired by, that of the family of cannibals from Scotland, the clan of Sawney Bean. If you'd like to hear this episode with pictures, all of our Debased on a True Story episodes are available at youtube.com/monstertalk. Now, the audio quality on this first one isn't up to our usual standards, but I'm working on getting better source files for future conversions from YouTube. Unfortunately, YouTube compresses our audio and makes it sound a little bit like an AM radio, so hopefully we can sort that out for upcoming episodes. You'll be hearing the voices of myself, Blake Smith, my regular co-host Karen Stolzno, and her husband Matt Baxter on these episodes. And check out the show notes for lots of reading about the movies and the legends behind the movies.
Monster Talk.
All right, we are live. Welcome again to Monster Talk Live. I'm Blake Smith.
Good morning, or good evening, or good night.
I'm Karen Stolzner. Whatever you may be. Yeah. Exactly. So let's see here.
And we've got Matt Baxter joining us again for another episode of Debased on a True Story, which is our current series that we're working on.
That's right. We're doing a series of stories about movies and the tie-ins to the real-life stories that they are based on. I say real life with quotation marks because, first of all, we
yeah, there's a lot more folklore than...
Yeah, I can't make sure of the video. Sorry about that. Sorry. Tonight, we're looking at The Hills Have Eyes, the movie by Wes Craven, and we'll be talking about...
Lots of spoilers.
This will be absolutely spoiler-ridden. It'll be fun. So... You can, be sure to like and subscribe to this video, and you can follow us on Patreon and support us on Patreon at patreon.com/monstertalk. And let's just sort of dive right into it, if you don't mind. I think This movie is Wes Craven's follow-up to The Last House on the Left, I think. This is 1977. Yep. It was directed by Wes Craven. It's called The Hills Have Eyes. It tells the harrowing story of a typical middle-class family and their run-in with a band of inbred, mutant, cannibal, desert bandits in a remote, irradiated bombing range in Arizona. The Carter family is led by retired cop patriarch Big Bob Carter and their very religious mom, Ethel Carter, and they're celebrating their anniversary by visiting an abandoned silver mine that they got as a gift. They're stopping there on their way to Los Angeles. Terrible spoiler. They don't make it to Los Angeles. They're accompanied by their daughter, Lynn, and her husband, Doug, and their baby, Katie, and also the Carter's teen kids, Brenda and Bobby. And on the other side of this family feud are the cannibal mutant family, headed up by Papa Jupiter, his adorable wife, who's known only as Mama, and their children, Mars, Pluto, Mercury, and their daughter, Ruby. And the cannibal clan has been surviving out here in this horrible wasteland by robbery, murder, and cannibalism. And this has led to poor social skills and, I have to say, very poor fashion choices. The Hills Have Eyes is a story about what happens when you push an average family too far. It is brutal. It's mean. It's sometimes exciting and it's frequently offensive. But we're going to talk about it tonight because Wes Craven says he was inspired to write it by the true story of a Scottish cannibal clan led by a man named Sawney Bean. All right.
And the average family pushed too far? I don't know.
Well, they had a, you know, so Bob's the retired cop. And like you do for your anniversary, you take your whole family and throw them in a camper and drive across the desert. That's what you do. So.
Yep. Yeah. Pretty good. Good idea. You know, and the thing is it, yeah, supposedly they had this old silver mine or something that was they owned in the family or something.
They seemed old, but I think they're only supposed to be in their 50s, which, okay, whatever.
It was a bit confusing. I wasn't sure if the eldest daughter, if that was a sibling to the mother. I got confused throughout. So
yeah, they were supposed to be like, it's, yeah. the casting's a little weird. I mean, like the people are a little older than they seem in some cases, a little younger in others. The guy who played Big Bob, he looked like he was in his mid-60s or 70s or something, early 70s. But I think he was only in his 50s.
I thought he was the grandfather of the team.
Yeah, he aged out early, bless his heart. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was your first time to see it, right, Karen?
It was my first time. I know that Matt hadn't seen it before either, or he'd seen one of the remakes or one of the sequels. And there are some movies that he refuses to watch, like this and Deliverance. So
I don't want to see
He doesn't want to see that. And so, yeah, I've never seen it. And
do not squeal like a pig. Okay.
It was filmed in Georgia. It's a Georgia classic.
So yeah, this is my first time. And and it's very much of its time. I mean, what was the budget for the movie? It was a couple $100,000.
I think it was $350, something along those lines. Yeah.
And they had to make it within a short time frame as well.
Yeah.
Didn't they? So yeah, it's certainly, I mean, for its time, it's interesting, and the script is interesting, and the fact that they came up with it so quickly is impressive.
It feels very much like it's an indie classic in the sense that made on a low budget, made a good return on the budget. I mean, it's not Wes Craven's most famous film by any stretch of the imagination. Wes came from a very religious family, and I think a lot of his early movies are very much sort of pushing back on that. In fact, if you look at the family itself, the mom's very religious. They pray before doing stuff. And I get the impression that him pushing back against the sort of strictures, you know. But it's also a low-budget movie. It seems to be heavily influenced by the success of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think his first movie, The Last House on the Left, is basically a rape revenge story. Yeah. And it's hard to watch, but it's a well-put-together movie. But it's disturbing. And this one, I think he was reluctant to go back into the horror film because he wanted to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. But this one made enough money to keep him going. And he got a really good established name as a director. And, of course, eventually ends up making, what's that one where the people shouldn't go to sleep? It has the Fred Krueger guy. That's the one. Yeah.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. So I was just talking with Sophie about that before we started doing this. And she was complaining because she's seen all the classics, she said. I've seen all the classics, Deb, and I haven't seen A Nightmare on Elm Street. And she went through a list. And I was like, holy crap, did we let you watch that one? Did we let you watch that one? Apparently, we're terrible parents, but I'll make sure she gets this classic too. So.
Well, Blade was here kind of sitting with us while we were watching it. And what's happening? What's that? And
Blade liked The Changeling better.
Oh, okay. I mean, it's not as, it's kind of like Texas Chainsaw. It's more brutal in your memory than it is in reality. Like it's, they don't actually show as much. Although honestly, also, I think they show more here, right?
We also watched a documentary with Wes Craven and all of the actors. And I think we watched that first and then watched the movie. And I think in watching the movie, I thought it wasn't as graphic or brutal as the way that they described it.
Yeah, I think at the time it would have come across as very, very brutal. I mean, it feels
77 for sure.
Yeah, it's not quite a snuff film, but it's pretty dark. I mean,
And didn't they receive an X rating initially, and then I think they had to cut it back and edit it to the point where they could get an R.
They did, and you can kind of tell at some places where it was edited really heavily. I guess again, this is not a spoiler free episode, so if you have not seen this film and you don't want ruination, here it comes. So. You've been warned.
Well, the ruination may come from actually seeing the film.
I mean, it's, you could probably shoot a better looking film on an iPhone at this point. That's true, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, as a creative person, I'm always leaning towards rooting for the filmmakers. Like, yeah, I know what they were trying to do, right?
Right.
And I feel like this was a really strong effort. And it's like the first big film with Dee Wallace in it. And then she goes on to become.
I got some slides on her in a second.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But it's an interesting movie. And the first name for it was actually Blood Relations, which I think is a great name. And I think it's a pity they couldn't keep that. You know, The Hills Have Eyes is spooky and creepy, but I kind of like the play on words with Blood Relations. That's a fun one. But yeah, it's, I don't know what to say about it. I'm not a fan of the slasher genre as much as I am the paranormal horror type movie. But I will say that a lot of these B ones are fun in the same sense that you were talking about, Blake, with the wanting to kind of root for these guys, you know, root for the filmmakers, because they are putting more passion into these low budget things than a lot of these filmmakers that have all the money.
Yes.
And
exactly.
That's a great aspect to it. And they do get some interesting actors as well. Now, of course, this picture of Michael Berryman is from the second movie, but it's still a great photo. I absolutely love it. And the thing about Michael Berryman is he's got this iconic face. A lot of it is from birth. He was a premature birth. And so his head's a little misformed and he's has no body hair. So no eyebrows or anything. So he's just a strange looking guy, but
you actually met him, haven't you, Matt?
I did meet him. Yeah. He's one of my favorite celebrity meetings that I've ever had, because he is the nicest guy on earth.
And never heard anybody say anything. Yeah. He always is described as one of the nicest people. And I saw him on Joe Bob Briggs did a coverage of this movie. And he was talking about Barrymore was talking about that he was actually part of the, I guess, atomic age, and that his father had been exposed to atomic bomb testing. So he was, a bomb explosion, and that was probably what caused his birth defects. But he's moved on and done great things with his life, and avid outdoorsman, big pet supporter. He's just an amazing guy. And everybody says it. If you go to a horror convention, meet him. He's just absolutely great.
And you know, he's an art history, got a degree in art history, which is interesting. But his work ethic is amazing. And I met him on the same night that I actually met Douglas Tate.
Nice.
Yeah. And Eileen Dietz from The Exorcist, nice. And Jonathan Breck from Jeepers Creepers. He was the creeper. We all went out to a haunted house that night. And, you know, we took him out for a ride in our bus. And it was a great time doing it, but Michael Berryman wasn't able to go with it. So I got to sit down and just talk with him for a little while before I took the rest of the guys out for the haunted house. And he was just fantastic. You know, when asked what does he ultimately want to do with his career? He said, I want to win the lottery and then be a philanthropist.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, he just wants to, you know, make sure that everybody can eat and everybody's taken care of. And yeah. He's just a beautiful man. He really is. But
the way he was portrayed in the movie, though.
We'll talk about that. But I think it's funny because he ends up on the poster. That they offered him, they said, you know, would you like to be on the poster? And as he says, that was $1 million worth of publicity. It's led to every other thing he's done. Now, this was not his first film. He was in One Floor of the Cuckoo's Nest. And
yes.
I can't think of the other one, but he was in other stuff before this. But but wow. Oh, Doc Savage. Yeah, I think he told a story on Joe Bob about his first job was with Doc Savage. And so, he was a Boy Scout. He's done lots of stuff, like say, with animal support. And just a great guy. But his photo on the box and the poster.
Iconic.
Absolutely eye-grabbing. You just like, what's this movie? You know, and so way to turn, you know, what could be a real problem into an asset. I mean, just wonderful. Like, you know, I mean, I think it would be a great world. Like, I think I've mentioned before, my mom was burned in college. So she's like 70% of her body at third degree burns. So she's heavily scarred. And So all my life I've been like, you know, I grew up with someone who's very scarred and I always just knew how debilitating that could be to your self-esteem, to have like some kind of difference, something different about you. And I always just try to ignore that stuff, but not everybody can. It's hard sometimes. And I love the way Berryman's taken what could be, the kind of thing.
Seen as ableist or something.
Yeah, yeah, he's great. I love it. He's inspirational. Well,
I think even in the movie, I think you almost have a sense of empathy for
him. Yes, he's the big bad. Yes.
He's the outsider. He's kind of trying to fit in with the rest of them.
Yes.
He's trying to do their bidding and prove that he's a man. And it just seems to me like he, could almost defect to the other side if given a chance, like Ruby.
Like Ruby, yeah.
Yep.
He's trying to impress his brothers, trying to impress his father, and not succeeding very well. Yeah. So I've never seen the second one because I heard such terrible things about it.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing here is this quote, the following film is based on fact.
They showed that at the start.
They showed that at the start of the second film, which is interesting because I think that the only movie that really claims to be based on a true story is the first one. So it's kind of odd that they would have that at the beginning of the second one. But, it still makes a good screen grab. Now, we were talking about Dee Wallace.
Yes.
Dee Wallace was a surprise. I know Dee Wallace mostly from, I think America knows her mostly from her as the mother in E.T. And then, but personally, I loved her in Cujo. She was the mother in Cujo.
Yes.
And that was my favorite.
That's a very scary movie, Matthew.
Yeah. So definitely interesting to see her in this movie and kind of get her career launched this way as well.
She really credited Wes Craven in the documentary that she saw. She said that really was a foot in the door for her and her career took off after that.
Absolutely. Should we explain that joke or just let it ride?
Well, I think another interesting thing, too, from watching the documentary, we really learned a lot from that, just behind the scenes things. And though, even though we're talking about, this might not be the best movie, it's a classic, but it's very much of its own time. It seems like these actors worked really hard for this movie. The working conditions were absolutely dreadful. They were working out in what was it, 115 degrees Fahrenheit day.
In the day, right. 115 or so in the day and 30 and then at night.
It was, brutal, cold desert winds. And it just seems like they didn't have enough to eat. There was absolutely nothing out there. They were staying in a shabby hotel. So it seems like they really put up with a lot to do this film and that a lot of them just wanted to do it to work with Wes Craven rather than necessarily to work for that film. They didn't think the script was very good.
Yeah. It sounds like they're pretty down on it. I obviously, over time, you know what? As we talk about this, we're going to get to the Sonny Bean stuff, but we will... we did a lot of research for this and we'll put a bunch of links in the show notes when this goes up to explain where we got our material from, especially around the Sonny Bean stuff. But I did read some pretty cool old issues of Fangoria about this and they had some great details in there as well. So
we got the Carter family here and there's six of them And they're kind of a mirror of the cannibals.
Exactly.
Which really we only got to see in action four of them. But there was Mama, and there was also Mercury, who we basically saw mostly in silhouette. But that was actually the producer that was doing a cameo as Mercury. So, you know, up in the corner here, we have Jupiter, who's the dad. And it was interesting. I did notice that throughout the movie, see, because his father smashed him in the face and split his face open like that.
Yep.
But his scars did kind of come and go.
They
were peeling off a bit too.
Yeah.
There was like, yeah, sometimes when the nose was kind of falling off. And yeah. But I suppose with that heat and the sweat, that would be a problem.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have Mars. Yeah, he was interesting with the sharpened teeth and the scare wig. And then we have good old Pluto, Michael Berryman. And then Ruby is the youngest and the one who ends up switching sides.
But, yeah, we had a few people ask, you know, Jupiter and Pluto, Ruby, what?
Yeah.
You know, it's weird. They didn't plan it.
Take a drink, everyone. Jeez.
All right. That was a good one. But yeah, so it's an interesting movie. And they talk about how, and I always wonder about this, because the critics start talking about how, you know, what the writer, you know, Wes Craven was going for was showing the two opposite sides, you know, with six here being on the good side, and six here being on the bad side, and, you know, first world and third world and all this different kind of stuff. But I wonder if any of that is actually true when he's forced to write something over a weekend, if he's really putting that kind of thought into it. And then afterwards, you know, you can post-dict, you know, that
post-diction.
Yeah, that, oh, this is what I was thinking. Of course.
It was, you know, as a former English major myself, it seems like the kind of stuff that you'd go into. Or it was like putting the die in dichotomy. Right? But it even goes down to the dogs. You've got Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast.
Which is, again, this, I mean, in the one sense, it's a fairy tale. But in the other sense, it's, you've got this dichotomy between Beauty and the Beast. And which one turns out to be more useful?
The Beast.
I say Beast.
The one who survives anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's not about the score. It's about who's winning at the end, right?
And I think things like that were pretty shocking for the time, too, when you see that gory scene with Beauty. I mean, we don't know exactly what happened to her, but I mean, she was obviously killed. But just the scene where they showed the dog with the entrails was pretty.
Yeah, cool. Which is one of those bits of trivia that apparently that was a real dead dog, you know. Yeah. So they didn't kill their dogs, but they did somehow obtain a dead dog. So
that's a pretty gruesome fact that there was.
But the
reality,
the Beast was played by the same German Shepherd that was the bionic dog on the Bionic Woman. So,
he's kind of a superstar.
I mean, yeah, he's very well. I mean, obviously, for all the amazing stuff he does in the movie, because I mean,
at the end as well. I mean,
he's kind of the hero,
really.
Yeah, he's totally the hero. He's definitely one of the most proactive members of the Carter clan.
He knew
what was going on from stage one. Like, he had it. So,
well, I think it's also interesting, you know, when you break down this whole. These families, you know, in the end are actually kind of the same, because this civilized family ends up having to be just as brutal, you know, in the end. And I don't know how much I really agree with that, because I think, you know, that's the difference between a wolf and a rabbit. You know, they both run, but one's running for a meal and one's running for his life.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we have here. So these people are having to defend themselves.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that I necessarily agree that they're the same, you know, in the end, because as brutal as the guy had to be killing them, in the end, he was getting revenge and he was in defense of everything.
For his wife and for the rest of his family and for his baby being stolen.
Yeah. So I think it's a little different, because, you know, the cannibal family was a little more gleeful murdering, you know.
Although I hear that they had to cut quite a bit out of the brutal...
The murder at the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he enjoyed it too much. He
enjoyed it too much. It's like, Well, you remember the old movie code stuff about the good guys, you know, the bad guys never can win, right? There always has to be some sort of moral lesson. And this was after that code was gone, as far as I know. But still, it sort of feels like that. You still have to get past the MPAA if you want to get on the rating system.
Exactly. Exactly.
Someone's commented the sidebar and asked why it's harder to see dead dogs in movies than people. And I think in this movie that was because their blood was orange.
What?
And not red. So it wasn't very convincing.
That's a great call out. That's a great call out.
Yeah.
The blood was very unconvincing.
Even with the mother, you know, when she dies and then they put her out as a decoy. I mean, don't you think she was on the verge of blinking there?
Well, in the distance,
she wants her heart. That's right.
Yeah, in the distance, she looked great.
Like, a lot of times they'll do that with a freeze frame, you know? Mm-hmm. And they didn't hear, you know, they had the same problem with Psycho where they were trying to keep Janet Leigh from moving her eyes or blinking. They fixed that with a freeze frame. But yeah.
Because she looked really dead, you know, from the distance, you know, the makeup and everything. She looked dead and it was really well done. But as soon as they zoomed in on her face, it was like, you know,
too much makeup.
Like we were saying, this is supposedly based on fact. And it's interesting because the facts that it's based on, two things: family of cannibals living in a cave.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that's basically it. And that's when we get into the folklore of Sawney Bean.
We did see with the interview with Wes Craven where he said that he was inspired. I think him and the producer, I can't remember his name, Peter.
Yeah. Peter Locke. Yep, you got it.
And so they drove out into the desert and they were trying to get some inspiration for the film. And so I don't know how he actually came across that story. I don't remember if he mentioned how it come across that story.
I'd heard that while he was doing research for what to write about, that came up. But it's also interesting. I mean, there are a lot of parallels between The Hills Have Eyes and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and some pretty strong, like, literal connections. Like, the prop master on both films was the same guy. And some of the props, therefore, are the same in both films. But,
well, and I think those two films ended up inspiring The House of a Thousand Corpses and various other ones.
Oh, they're very, yeah, we'll be coming back to Texas Chainsaw because that falls into the Ed Gein stuff as well.
Yeah, it's a very, you wouldn't see an immediate connection, I think.
But like you do have a family that is cannibalistic and killing people in a rural setting. And I would say that the protagonist would not be considered universally likable. There's a lot going on. They kind of drive into a scenario where they really have no business and horrific events or hilarity ensues. So I mean, there are a lot of parallels. So, but basing
on hilarity in Sawney Bean,
there's not really. No, it's not that funny of a story. But it is an interesting story. We'll sort of dig into it here.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
So when we started this idea of doing these debates on true stories, I expected that we would find some of the stories were only partially true or had been inflated. And this is one that I mean, to be honest, I fully expected this was a somewhat true story that had gotten grossly inflated. However, everything I've read in my research suggests this story is entirely made up, and it's really interesting in how it's made up, or I found it really interesting. So,
yeah, I think we've got some different perspectives on this. So we'll chat and share our views.
Yeah. So a lot of the work that, or a lot of the things I read concur with an article in Folklore Journal. There's an article called Sawney Bean, the Scottish Cannibal, which was published in 1997. And that is by Sandy Hobbs and David Cornwell. And so I'll be pulling some details out of that. And I mean, there's some good stuff in, I found something in 40 and Times. And obviously the Wikipedia is not terrible, I found a lot of different information.
Well, I think a lot of sources take it as a given, though, that this character existed.
It's interesting, isn't it? Sandy Hobbs and David Cornwell, they tried to track it down to like its earliest source. And the first source they were able to find was a book called The Lives and Actions of the Most Famous Highwaymen by a pseudonym of Captain Charles Johnson. And there were some questions about who that was. And there were four other books around the same time, but they all seemed to pull back from that one. So that was the earliest one they were able to track down. Do we want to kind of talk through the story of Sawney Bean and what he was supposed to have done?
Basically, and I've done a bunch of looking into this. Supposedly, this guy, Alexander Bean, was he was a rough kid. And his dad was a ditch digger, basically. And he didn't want to go into the family business for some reason. But that really made him made him appear to be a real layabout and everything. So he hooked up with this equally vicious woman. Nothing was mentioned about him being vicious before, but suddenly now this equally vicious woman, Black Agnes, they hooked up and took off and kind of made their way.
Mama. Yeah, mama.
Yeah, mama. They made their way across Scotland. And started holing up in this cave and just were robbing people that came by. And then they, realized that food would be good as well. So they started eating these people as well. You got to do what you got to do.
Say, mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Can I throw a bit of nerdery in here? A little nerdy. So sure. When I was doing the research, one of the things that comes up in these stories is his parents were hedgers and ditchers, but he didn't like that work and he ran away. Mm-hmm. And I really had a hard time finding out what hedgers and ditchers meant, but it came up a lot in like English stuff in the 1920s. But I finally tracked something down from a book called Jane Austen's Name, which is like an annotated look at the contextual details of the work of Jane Austen. And they have this excerpt I wanted to read, which says hedges had provided man-made boundaries, even in prehistoric Britain, and emerge into history in legal documents. References to hedgerows and Anglo-Saxon charters are abundant, with the hedges frequently being employed as boundary markers. In Austen's time, the hedgerow was an important working part of the human landscape. Digging drainage ditches and planting hedges was among the hardest labor of the poorest paid rural laborers, hedgers and ditchers. We have to imagine Jane Austen's handmade landscape as worked by human beings, creating and maintaining a visible functional boundary. So I thought that was pretty cool because I really didn't know what the hell meant.
I was thinking of a hedgerow. So.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. I didn't really think about how they
got there. Another job of its time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now,
so what era are we talking about, too? Because I'm not sure that we've talked about the century.
The 1500s.
Yeah.
Somewhere between the 1500s and 1600s, because they don't actually give it a real solid date.
Yeah.
All we know is it's James I's rule of Scotland, which was from, I'd have to go back and look,
He was in the 17th century, so.
I can get it right here. I can tell you exactly that, it was from 1567 to 1603, basically. It's right in that time period. And the interesting thing is I first found the story of him in the Newgate Calendar. And I don't know if the Newgate Calendar is before what you found, Blake, or if it's after. But that was the first reference that I could find.
I don't know. Let me look it up.
And the Newgate Calendar was an interesting book because it was one of those ones that, like the Bible, was in almost everyone's home. And it was given to children or read to children as a bit of a cautionary tale on how not to behave. And so it is full of these stories of terrible, horrible things. But it was published, and there's actually quite a few publications that are also called the Newgate Calendar. But this main one was between 1750 and 1850. So within that 100 years,
there was like pretty close.
A bunch of issues. So yeah, so 100 year, 200 years afterwards.
Was an English publication? Or?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. In London, yeah. And then the book that I was talking about was from 1730. So yeah, not terribly far from each other. Yeah.
So either way, we're looking at almost a 200 year possibly difference between when it supposedly happened compared to when it was published.
It's kind of like the Bible.
Yeah.
So that in itself kind of, you know, doesn't lend it a whole lot of reality.
Credibility.
But yeah, so anyway, you've got, you know, Sonny Bean getting into this cave with this woman, and then they start, you know, procreating and needing food. So they're killing people and eating them, and it goes on and on, and they're killing like up over 1,000 people, you know, by the end of it.
Yes. That's a lot of people. Yeah.
There's a lot of people. And so it's an interesting thing. In fact, trying to find the cave itself.
Well, that's an interesting point. So the 1,000 people are supposed to have gone missing or, you know, and according to the story, because they go missing on trips, they're travelers traveling from various things, and they go missing. Innkeepers are allegedly convicted on hearsay for these deaths. So not only are the victims themselves gone, but also locals who really had nothing to do with it are also being killed or executed just for crimes they didn't commit. Oh, and they're hiding in a cave. There's something special about the cave, Matthew, because this cave is underwater part of the day.
Yes. I wasn't sure if that's where you were going, but that's one of the reasons it was so hard to find is because when the tide came in, and I can show you a couple of examples of that in a moment. But I think
it was born in those conditions.
Well, because it rose up after the water. Yeah. So like,
you could go into the cave and then it kind of went up. So when it was covered in water, the inside of the cave was still safe. So just pretty far, far back. But so he was born near Edinburgh.
East Lothian, which is, if I remember correctly, pretty well, it's not too far. East Lothian, which is east of Edinburgh.
Isn't the location of the caves disputed, though?
Yes.
Well, wildly disputed. We're gonna get into that. Yeah, we're gonna get into that. So let's go back out here. Now, if you go to Google Maps and you put in this particular address, it will say Sawney Bean's Cave in Google Maps. Yeah, and
whatever Google says, it must be true. No, sorry.
Exactly. So you zoom in on it, and it's actually a house. So I'm not so sure that that's correct.
Well, it's heavily. It's a big part of tourism lit now. And tourism, so there could be a gift shop there. I'd stop and ask. So.
But
you don't need it in here, the cafe, though.
There actually is a cave that's in this area here. And it's got a plaque and everything. Now a lot of people will swear that this is Sonny Bean's cave. And I'm just gonna show real quick here. Let's hop back over to this.
Like there are many caves around there. It looks like it's coastal and beach. And
but there's a plaque in this area, and it says Snib Scott's cave. Now the thing is there's actually a bricked up door over the very entrance of the cave that Snib Scott put there. And so that's why they call it Snib Scott's cave. They're saying that he did it to kind of protect, you know, anyone from going in and hurting themselves in this horrible place. So I don't know if that's true or not.
Okay. One version of the legend is that the cave was blown up, or the entrance was blown up.
So, yeah, the cave could be anywhere. We actually just don't know where it is, but there's several spots. And I think you could find any cave along this coastline, and you could say it's the one, because they are fairly, the cave systems are fairly extensive back through here. So, but those are the two most popular locations that I could find.
But who was now, this? If we go back for a second to this Scott guy, who was this, one of the caves that is attributed to Sawney Bean? Who was he? He was just a.
Well, he was a hermit.
He was like an early 20th century hermit, right?
Yeah.
I saw some pictures of that. Also, the dissociation of Benet Head and Ballantrae, which is the Ballantrae is the, and I apologize to all our Scottish listeners if I'm just absolutely slaughtering this.
You are.
And then Benet Head is the cave about 3.5 miles north of Ballantrae. But that came from a fictional story called The Gray Man, written in 1896. And up until that point, it wasn't really specified where the cave was. And that novel was published as fiction, but it became so popular that everybody started assuming that it was really the location, which I find fascinating. Very much like the scripted ideas we talk about, where fiction pushes folklore into interesting directions. So again, right. we'll put notes about that in there. But yeah, interesting. It went from being in a book to being accepted wisdom that is what the case, right?
What happens. And this is an interesting work of art. And we kept seeing this being attributed to Sawney Bean as though this was a picture or a depiction of his family and their meals and celebrations.
They're enjoying on a spittle, or they've got a barbecue going. I recognize the barbecue.
It's difficult to see. I know Matt's looked into it, so I'm keen to hear what he has to say. But when I took a look at it last night, I thought it was interesting because it looked more like some kind of tribal artwork. It looked like there were people who were wearing, I think it was a fellow who was wearing some kind of jewelry made of bones or something. But it looked to me like it was a representation of, like a colonial representation of the English going into a country and subjugating the natives and who were just brutal savages who would eat people. So I'm curious to find out what this was actually a depiction of.
It is a depiction of the cannibals in Brazil.
Ah,
supposedly.
okay.
By the Portuguese, this is how the Portuguese viewed the natives of Brazil. And so it is a Portuguese artist, and it was done 1500 and something. I can't remember exactly. We can have
So it's got nothing to do with the Sawney Bean story.
Nothing to do with Sawney Bean.
Totally different recipes.
Yeah.
Different spices.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, they are much more spicy.
But I wonder if there is still a link, though, between this depiction, which is being attributed to Sawney Bean, and maybe the way that the English saw the Scottish and why they were written about as being such brutes and such savages.
Actually, that's interesting because what you're pointing out is that the original narratives were written in London by British people about the Scots who, as we discussed with the royalty issues, it wasn't a United Kingdom yet. It was that was a ways away. And I'm not an expert in that history. But I did find it interesting, the idea that maybe it might have been written as derogatory. But I don't think, I mean, I guess after all my reading, it feels more like it's not that it's necessarily anti-Scottish. It's more like I've got this awesome story about these crazy rednecks that are cannibal inbred people. I need to put it somewhere rural. Right. It can't be in England because that's not rural enough. Let's push it a little further north.
They were pretty brutal, you know, toward the Scots. And I'm sorry, Karen, you go ahead.
And the Irish and the Welsh.
Yes.
So for quite some time, they've looked down on other parts of the United Kingdom.
Apparently still in many ways, but yeah.
Absolutely. And Matt, you found out something interesting about Sawney as a name.
Well, yeah, the name Sawney does get used a lot in during that time to kind of make fun of the Scottish, and it's kind of interesting. It's usually with someone. It started off anyway with someone with the first name of Alexander, which was actually Alistair as well. And the Scottish Gaelic version of that, I believe, was Alice Jav. And thank you. and so that kind of ended up being seen as Sawney. And then they started making that like this cartoonish.
It's,
you know,
very much like you might hear people in New York say Italian people are Guido, right? It's a real name, but it's being used as a single
name, like a Karen,
right?
Or like a Karen. Thanks, Karen.
I mean, I think names have always been used to label stereotypes, and So it's really sounding to me like that was a stereotype of a savage, a primitive Scottish person.
In the Newgate calendar, they have a ton of stories about all these different, you know, villains. And we have here, I'll just read you really quickly. They have a British guy, and they call him Alistair, interestingly enough. And then they have the Scottish guy, Sawny Bean. And then they have the Scottish guy, Sawny Cunningham. And, it, you know, it does go on and on. Sawny Douglas. So it is just something they called him. So it's not even a real name in a sense. It's more of an insult. So yeah. That does make it interesting.
Well, I did, around the same time those other chapbooks came out in the 1730s, 1740s, there was another book, and it's almost identical, but it's called The History of John Gregg and His Family of Robbers and Murderers. And that story is set in Devon, but otherwise it's a complete ripoff. And in fact, in the story itself, I guess a lot of the geography doesn't actually make sense, because they were basically just saying, well, I can't put it there. I'll move it down here. I'll move that over there. But like they didn't have a really clear picture of geography, and they had a copy of a book they were ripping off. Its copyrights were different back then. So, yeah.
Yeah. They had the story of Christy Cleek was another one that was almost identical. So it is interesting that there was a lot of this. And the Newgate calendar only wanted to exist for the purpose of scaring kids into doing the right thing, and to the political side of things, of making anyone that wasn't, from England to be, you know, made out to be a savage.
With The Hills Have Eyes, we know what happened to the cannibal family. What happened with the Bean family then? What was the, according to folklore, what was the end of the story?
Well,
there are several variations.
Well, I was going to say, what happens is, A couple is coming from a fair, and they are assaulted by the Bean clan, but they get the wife, but the husband turns out to have cool fighting skills and a weapon. And he manages to hold them off long enough that other people traveling from the fair are coming. The Beans grab the wife, leave, and head away. The coming other people help him. And they get help, and they go and get like the local magistrate or sheriff or whatever. And they eventually end up getting the king and an army of people to go invade the cave, pull the family out. They take it back to Edinburgh, and then they don't have a trial. They kill all of them, including the children. And there's a reason for that, because in the folklore, anyone who has tasted human flesh ever, wow, you got that. You got to have it. It's so good. It's so good. It's so good.
It's like anyway. Like a creature tasting blood.
Yes, yeah. Once they get the taste,
they call it long pork.
That's right, long pig. But they do say that, like, they had other examples in folklore where a child had been saved from a cannibal family, like, and then goes on to, when they get to their teenage, like, you know what I could really go for right now, man, barbecue, right? So
chunk of ass would be great.
And I mean, if they don't just kill them either. They burn the women on a pyre, and they basically, they castrate all the men and then draw and quarter them, if I remember correctly. So,
well, they cut off their hands and feet and let them bleed to death.
But without their winkies. So,
yes, their winkies are, and the women had to watch that before they were then burned. So it is interesting, but you know, going back to the whole fight in the, you know,
we didn't mention they were so inbred. There's like 48 of them. Okay, there's a lot. There's kids and grandkids. So yeah, that's a lot. So
yeah. And so there's a whole bunch of them against this one guy. So I don't care how good your fighting skills are, I'm not buying.
I have to assume that they didn't bring the whole 48 out, right? Yeah, no, that would not work. So whatever they did the Zerg rush of beans. What's that?
I remember Wes Craven in this, the documentary that we watched, he was talking about how he thought, and I think that was inspiration for the end of the film with the regular family, the average family, turning and becoming what they loathed, and this other family, the cannibals who'd attacked them. He was talking about how when he looked into the history of the Sawny Bean story, how he thought it was just brutal that they had this family were a pack of cannibals, and then that the government had come in and had treated them pretty much in the same way with all of these, you know, cruel and unusual punishments. And I just have to say, from my understanding of English history, that that's not what they would have done. Things like hanging and drawing and quartering, that was usually reserved for traitors to the king. And usually people would be hanged for something like that. People wouldn't be burnt for something like that either. That would usually be the lot of maybe witches earlier on.
Black Agnes was alleged to be a witch, although I don't.
But then I think by that point, that was really a punishment for blasphemy. So it just doesn't ring true to me. And I think at this point too, again, it depends what era you're talking about. But James would have then been the King of England. So I don't think he would have even been in Scotland then. He was the King of England and Scotland after Elizabeth I died. So, yeah, it just the history
He was the King of Scotland first, and that's when this took place, was during his reign just as the King of Scotland.
Okay.
But even then, I think you're right. I don't.
There's some crossover, and sometimes it was in the early 17th century, and so by that point he would have been in England.
The difficult part is the dates aren't clear. So you're absolutely right.
Discussing with Matt too, just how intricate records were by this point. I've looked at records myself of functions that Henry VIII held, and there would be a record of the cost of half of a lemon that they used in some big celebration. So it just seems to me that there would be a lot of solid evidence to back up this story if it had actually happened. It really seems like it's legend and folklore and some kind of, you know, beware, be careful, don't do this kind of thing. This is, you know, a cautionary tale. It just doesn't seem to add up. As interesting of a story as it is, it just seems like there are so many versions of it. It just doesn't ring true to me.
Right. I think it's hard to prove a negative, but we don't have any records of 1,000 people going missing. We don't have any records of this gigantic 48-person massacre.
Well, the population was so much smaller than 1,000 people disappearing. That would be huge.
Yeah. And also,
on the map here, I've got it kind of focused in on the town of Leith, where the executions took place. It looks beautiful there, but so this is where it supposedly took place. And I'm not sure. My guess would be that it took place here somewhere. But it's interesting to look and kind of see these places where it supposedly happened, and yet there's no records of any of it. It's just there's nothing.
And to give you some context, around the same time as this allegedly happened, you got Peter Stump, the alleged werewolf we've talked about before.
Court records of that.
Yeah, and he got killed. One guy got killed, and there were woodcuts and celebratory images around his death. So I can't even imagine if someone had killed 1,000 people, what that would be like. So
a family of 40, absolutely.
So big pile of unlikeliness here. All right. Well, we've run out of time, unbelievably. But I did enjoy talking about this. I loved all the research. Thanks so much for your work on this too, Matthew, Karen, and the graphics.
I think it's a great legend. I mean, it's a ghastly legend, but it's very interesting. And the movie, I mean, it's certainly, if it didn't happen, it's inspired a classic movie.
Absolutely. And really helped Michael Berryman's career, and that's always good. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to say be sure to follow us on, us here, subscribe to our feed, follow us on patreon.com/monstertalk. You can support us there. And we really appreciate you tuning in. Thank you so much.
And one other thing before we go, comment and talk about other movies you want us to cover in this sense based on a true story. And we'll get to all that we can.
Monster Talk.
You just heard Blake Smith, Karen Stolzno, and her husband Matt Baxter discussing the 1977 Wes Craven film, The Hills Have Eyes, and the underlying legend of Sawney Bean, the Scottish cannibal. We hope you'll check out the rest of our series on youtube.com/monstertalk, where you can find many other episodes of this series, as well as our ongoing feature, Monster Talk Live. Thanks for your patience while I recover from COVID, and thanks to our patrons who helped make this show financially viable. You can join them at patreon.com/monstertalk for as little as $3 a month. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. And as always, and especially right now, thank you so much for listening, supporting our show, giving us positive reviews, and just being a part of the Monster Talk family. We truly appreciate it.
This has been a Monster House presentation.